white supremacist and neo-Nazi recruiters do use gaming spaces because they see it as an effective way to reach their younger target audiences.
Hi, I'm Anna Krane. I'm the research manager at Tech Against Terrorism, an organization that supports the global tech sector tackle terrorist and violent extremist use of the internet whilst respecting human rights. Welcome back to another episode of our podcast. This week, we're discussing online gaming platforms and the rise of extremism in the gaming space. We provide a deep dive on the topic, unpicking the concerns around gaming and radicalization, before discussing what can be done to get ahead of this threat as gaming technologies rapidly advance. Online gaming platforms are enjoyed by billions of people around the world and provide a vast and diverse community for individuals to connect, compete, and have fun. However, these platforms can be vulnerable to exploitation by extremist actors seeking to advance their own ideological worldviews. The immersive and interactive nature of online gaming and gaming communities can create an environment where individuals are more susceptible to ideological influence. And this has been demonstrated in recent years by attacks which were planned, attempted, or perpetrated by individuals who were active in gaming communities. A recent example is the perpetrator of the Buffalo mass shooting in 2022, who used gaming-adjacent platforms to plan and then to livestream the attack. Our guests today are Galen Lam for England, a violent extremism and strategic communications researcher and fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, and Dr. Jessica White, a senior research fellow in RUSI's Terrorism and Conflict Group. Together, Galen and Jessica have co-founded the Extremism and Gaming Research Network, or EGRN, an international body researching the nexus between extremism and gaming while implementing activities that tackle the misuse of video games and gaming platforms by extremist actors. I started by asking Jessica why gaming platforms in particular were such a cause for concern and why she felt research was so desperately needed in this space.
The last 20 years of counterterrorism have been very myopically focused on the threat of the international threat of often Islamist violent extremism. And there's been, you know, a massive amount of military action taken against the threat that we saw from ISIS. And that is scaling back in some ways. And now we're seeing a shift in the counterterrorism space to thinking about, okay, what are some of the future threats? And I think in that shift, there's been a real recognition of the online space and what we do and don't know about the online space, perhaps a fear amongst some of the security community that are less well-versed in what the online space even is, the dynamics of it, the diversity of it. And I think that is where this question about online gaming has really come from. We started with the question about social media, and there was a more long-running conversation about what do we do about social media, what the concerns are, how do we protect people's freedoms, but also try and limit harms in that space. And I think that that conversation did not really reach to the online gaming space until very much more recently, in the last few years that we've been doing the Extremism and Gaming Research Network. And I think that we entered at a good time, really, because now the conversation has, I think, switched in more focus to the online gaming space, as we've seen that, you know, several prominent attackers have live streamed their attacks on gaming adjacent platforms. We've seen that, you know, video game content, and really this goes back to ISIS, video game content features prominently in propaganda that's produced by many different violent extremist or terrorist organizations or groups or networks. So I think the conversation is now turning, you know, to, okay, there's another space in this online dimension that we need to think about. There's been a long-running conversation about violence in video games, but it hasn't really until more recently touched on the issue of violent extremism in the online gaming space. And do we, you know, how do we work on that? How do we make gaming communities more resilient to that? And I think that is where this conversation has really centered. And I think it's a conversation that will continue into the future because we're going to see more virtual reality metaverses, you know, more interaction of everyday life in the online sphere. So I definitely think that from a counterterrorism practitioner perspective, this is a space that needs to be understood better. The language of what the threat is needs to be communicated to security professionals. And of course, we need to work with the gaming communities and the gaming companies to really understand how we can relay information to them in a way that they can make changes and make foster resilience in their spaces.
So what is it about gaming communities that can foster concerning attitudes towards misogyny, racism, and even violent extremism? Galen gave his thoughts, starting with a word of caution.
We should not be stigmatizing games and gamers. We should be looking at one giant social space and spaces inside of that, that some of which can have particularly problematic practices, ideologies, beliefs, and behaviors. Now, that being said, there's a couple things that are unique about games, right? One is that unlike traditional social media, where you're exchanging general messages, you're developing kind of these loose ties and these loose networks. When you're playing multiplayer games with other people, you're actually building much tighter connections. You're building what Graham Bader would have called strong ties or strong network ties. So you're looking at much more tight-knit relationships online. You're developing something towards a common end. You're often playing towards a common objective. And psychologically speaking, you actually have a lot tighter connection with people. That's a good thing, right? That can form a sense of community, a sense of really engaging better with others. And that can have really pro-social outcomes. But when you're looking for a sense of meaning, a sense of identity, or a sense of belonging, you find that community. And that community has really toxic behavioral practices or ideological beliefs, you can then get pulled in a really problematic direction quite quickly. So in gamer communities, for a long time, there's been discussion of deep-seated misogyny and racism. We had Gamergate a number of years ago and kind of the underlying misogynistic norms that fuel that. More recently, we see normalized, intensified racism in many gaming-related spaces. And that has like long-standing antecedents. That's been around for 20 plus years. But we're seeing exploitation of those underlying factors by violent extremist organizations and individuals who seek to find both a sense of community and a sense of belonging, a sense of normalization of their beliefs, and can seek to exploit and weaponize those underlying similar thoughts of their own towards a violent end to advance those beliefs, namely by violent ends to often attack civilians. So those sort of live stream attacks that we've seen, individuals who found a sense of community online, they were not, you know, self-radicalized or lone wolf actors, they usually had a sense of community and a sense of identity that they found in gaming-related spaces, and then set out to commit acts of terror. In the case of the Buffalo attacker, as we found in some of our research and our colleagues' research, he really found a sense of community and admitted building a lot of his nationalist identity through specific modifications for Roblox, so an online youth-centered gaming ecosystem. We've also seen cases of individuals, children, who have been radicalized to violent extremist ideologies in Germany and in Singapore, who did not go on to commit violence, but were planning to and were intercepted by law enforcement while doing so. And in those different case studies, we've primarily seen kids who are looking for social belonging. They were trying to find a sense of a group, a sense of identity. They met them typically through online multiplayer games and specific servers that were formed around either nationalistic or violent extremist ends that were built into the mini games that were designed. And then out of that, they then started to find their outlink to other places for communication that were more closed and intensified the level of ideological recruitment that they were being subjected to.
Online gaming grows in popularity every year and is becoming increasingly accessible to younger and younger audiences. I asked Galen whether children using these platforms are at increased risk of exposure to extremist ideas.
I think there's three really critical differences inside of this, right? So like, yes, many more people play games now than they used to. Lots more kids, virtually almost all kids who have access to the internet or access to computers play games at this point. So yes, like general access is huge. And that does change the exposure to overall content. But exposure is only one facet here. Like interactivity, like Jess was mentioning, plays a massive role, as does the gamification of content. So if you look at an educational setting, if you go from having rote learning, you go from having tests and textbook-based learning to game-based learning, it's very effective for retention of information and for getting students more engaged. The same holds true for gamifying violent extremist content or terrorist content. If you gamify it, people learn the ideologies behind it more readily, they engage with it, and they retain that information for a lot longer period of time. So when you gamify violent extremism, you actually increase your engagement with your target audience, and you increase their likelihood to retain that information and then act on it in the long term. So gamification actually does change the game in terms of a particular tactic that is very effective. And we also know that there is weaponized uses of these spaces. So our colleagues have interviewed white supremacist and neo-Nazi recruiters who do use gaming spaces because they see it as an effective way to reach their younger target audiences. You want to reach people when they're young. You want to convert people to their ideas when they're more susceptible and less so when they're older. So if you're trying to reach a younger target demographic, gaming online spaces are a great way to do that. And then lastly, like the moderation around this is much less so in many gaming spaces than it is on a lot of social media platforms that have had more intense scrutiny over the past 5 to 10 years. So there are more trust and safety or moderation efforts on many other platforms, whereas a lot of gaming platforms have been perceived as not being necessarily social spaces. They're perceived as being games, but that's not necessarily how people engage with many gaming-related platforms.
I wanted to know whether the actual content of a video game makes a difference in its potential to radicalize its players. I asked Jessica.
There is an issue around the mechanics of the game and how the game works and the narrative of the game. But I think there's communities that are drawn to certain games. And in those communities, if you look at the conversation that's happening in the offline community of, you know, how to avert radicalization within security forces or within militaries, within police forces. If you look at the conversations that are happening around that and what the dangers are in the offline space, you can kind of see that then reflected back into the online gaming space, or you can see the online gaming space reflect that back from the offline space. So if we're concerned about a hypermasculine, you know, culture, environment in the security forces that can reduce people's resilience to violent extremism because they might be encouraging misogynist language and they might be encouraging, you know, in-group, out-group formation, you can see that then reflected in the online gaming communities that are playing some of these games where they're using that same cultural element to build their community around the game. And it might be, if there's, you know, a military simulation game, it might be a first-person shooter game, but it's more about that cultural environment that is being fostered in relation to that game and how you know, misogyny can be used and how that in-group out-group formation is used as part of that online community dynamic. And I think that is, it certainly is partly how the games are framing, you know, the storylines of the games, how the games are drawing people in, but it's also about the communities that are forming around the games and the kind of behavior that is or is not encouraged in those communities.
There is no clear link between violence in the video games and offline violence. Now, that being said, there's a big old caveat by that, which is like the narrative content, the stories that are told in games can interact with what people then do in the rest of their lives, right? So if you're playing games that have a really strong ideological component to them, or that depict really misogynistic or really dire narratives, like, yeah, that probably does impact how you engage elsewhere in life. It's understudied and we don't fully understand those linkages. And that's something that as a network and through our members, we're trying to do a bit better. So there are also, in addition to kind of mainstream games that maybe have really worrisome narratives, there's also violent extremist and terrorist produced games and content. So we've categorized at least 30 plus either mods, modifications to existing games, or standalone games produced by violent extremists or violent extremist organizations, ranging from Daesh or ISIS, to Hezbollah, to neo-Nazi groups in the US, in the UK, and in Germany. And those are still being produced. So like we see actual games that are being made, as well as kind of broader narrative questions or story questions in mainstream games as well, that we don't fully understand.
So what can be done to better understand and counter extremism within gaming? I asked Jessica what she felt policymakers, gaming companies, and other stakeholders could be doing.
There's a conversation that is happening and needs to happen around, you know, what is it possible to regulate against? You know, what is it actually that is illegal that we can say this has to be removed based upon a legality issue of it being connected to, supportive of whatever definition of terrorism that particular country holds, which of course complicates a transnational issue because you have different country legislative, you know, perceptions of what terrorism is, how you define it, how you can legislate against it. Then there's a more complicated question of what about all this content that is hateful? It's maybe it's sexist, maybe it's racist, maybe it's all of these hateful things, but it's not actually crossing that threshold of illegal content. And if it's legal, but it's still awful, then that I think becomes more the purview of the discretion of the companies themselves. And what do they want to do? What do they have the will to do within their companies? What do they have the capabilities to do as far as removing or moderating or preventing this type of awful but lawful, if you like that phrase, content on their platforms? The question of prevention is a really interesting one. I think probably looking back, the Preventing Encountering Violent Extremism field hasn't been great about adopting the online gaming space or understanding it so much. So I think there's a way to go in helping translate the body of knowledge that exists around what works in preventing encountering violent extremism into how it could work in the online gaming space, but also into using the online gaming space as a positive tool. We have, members of the EGRN that are police departments, working with local communities, and they play esports with them in a way to build a bond of trust with that community. And that might not be about violent extremism, but in building that bond of trust with a community that has historically had challenging relationship with the police, they are using the gaming as a positive engagement space. And then that perhaps builds resilience in that community to the challenges that they might be facing, violent extremism or otherwise.
Galen also shared his thoughts.
So I think one, on the platform side, designing better trust and safety and content policy and community guidelines is incredibly important. Understanding how that interlinks with sensible regulation is critical. But then on the behavioral side is where I think there's an enormous amount of potential, right? Of working on behavioral change questions inside of gaming platforms and gamer communities, I think makes sense for two reasons, right? One, you're going to start losing users who are sick of being harassed, doxxed, bullied, just on the kind of the more prosaic level of things. And then on the parents or the regular side, seeing actual risks of violent extremism or terrorism or other types of social harms leveraging from platforms. You want to deal with those behaviors earlier on. That comes from building safer, more inclusive, more less toxic online communities. So thinking of these as communities and working on behavioral change questions inside of them can work. There's some gaming studios that have really tried to change their ways of addressing racist or misogynistic or bullying behaviors to actually engage in behavioral nudges with their players rather than just banning them or trying to get rid of them, because often people just change the username, buy a game key, come back in, get a VPN, change your IP. It's not hard, right? But you can actually work on behavioral nudges to gradually bring people along a pathway to understand what behaviors are acceptable or not in online gaming spaces if you want to keep playing that game. So you can engage in long-term behavioral change to build a bit nicer communities, frankly. I think that's really worth investing in. There's ways to work with that.
Turning to the future, I asked our guests for their opinions on the rise of virtual reality and how they predict it might impact radicalization and extremism on gaming platforms.
I think the questions of how reality will change is incredibly interesting, right? Because virtual reality implies that there is like a real and a non-real aspect to it. I would argue that as our vision of reality changes, so like what happens online or offline still impacts you as an individual. It still impacts us as a society. It's still very real in a lot of senses. And as virtual reality or augmented realities become more and more intensely realistic simulations of what happens in the physical world, like that type of reality will become more and more impactful on people and on society. So like there's this kind of growth curve where what happens in virtual spaces will influence everything else around it more and more intensely. There's two interesting kind of like forks for that when it comes to radicalization and extremism. One is that we will see more intensified problems related to socialization in spaces that there are not community norms and standards around. I think largely because like pseudonymic spaces or anonymous spaces where it's not linked to your identity, it's not linked to repercussions for how you engage in the rest of your social life, like those can get really toxic very quickly. So you have to tackle kind of that aspect. And then the other aspect is, no one has quite talked about this yet, I'm very curious to see where this goes, when you have harms that are purely in virtual spaces, right? when you start seeing attacks that are purely in cyber or purely online that actually impact individuals, you can see this now with like blackpilling or bullying that can lead to suicide online. When we start seeing terrorist or violent extremist organizations attacking virtual reality spaces or augmented reality spaces in ways that are, it feels like it's reality to you as the user, and then someone blows up that space or harasses you so intensely in a way that you feel absolutely damaged, your community feels permanently damaged. Is that an act of terrorism? Is that an act of violent extremism? No one's quite answered that yet. And I think it's a fascinating question mark for the future based on how far this will go. That's a bit of an off-track set of questions to go into, but I think it's incredibly interesting. And at the end of the day, the policy responses and the practical responses, both on the platform side and the regulatory side, need to address some of those questions, as well as the fact that we're seeing, you know, these imminent risks today. We should be thinking of what's coming down the track in the next 5 to 10 years too.
Jessica shared Galen's views and highlighted how the move towards a more immersive virtual reality is likely to intensify the issues around gamer identity that we're already seeing.
Online games as they exist today can elicit the same sort of physiological response. If you were, you know, with your gaming community, you're fighting a battle in a Milsim game, that the same sort of physiological chemical reactions in your body and your brain are happening as they would if you were actually fighting in a real life conflict in a war zone. And I had a little bit of a hard time sort of believing that at first, because I think, you know, sort of how can the online experience be, you know, eliciting that same physiological response as actually experiencing danger in that way together. But as studies show, it does, and the evidence shows that it does. And I think that if online games as they exist today can elicit that same physiological response, and if your identity can become so fused with your online identity that you don't see a distinction in your mind from who you are online and who you are in real life, as we move towards virtual realities or whatever realities we're going to call them that are so realistic or become a part of our reality, then there will be even less distinction between that the identities that you might hold in your physical life and your online life. And I just think that that is a really difficult concept to wrap your head around, especially if you're not intensely involved in this space and the research going on in this space. But I think that is something that definitely challenges our notion of what radicalization is, how it happens, how we counter radicalization in those spaces. And I think that we're going to have to grapple with that in a way that we don't quite understand yet. But it's a really interesting thing about sort of the way people's identities are formed. And we know that identity formation is a huge part of radicalization processes. We know that there is most definitely the search for community, the search for identity is a significant part for a lot of people. So I think that's something just to consider as we move into new spaces, more realistic virtual spaces, that there is already the propensity to have these environments where you really don't distinguish between your online identity and your offline.
Finally, Galen shared his advice to parents, practitioners, and gamers alike to meaningfully engage with this topic and stay vigilant against the risks we've discussed today around gaming and extremism.
If you're a parent or an educator, if you have kids or you have a cousin or you work with children, and they are playing games, I can guarantee you, unless you grew up in a cabin in the woods like I did, so I guess there are exceptions, but for the most part, ask what they're playing. Learn who their friends are online. Engage with gaming spaces as though they're real spaces. The friendships there are real, I guarantee you. So get to know those spaces. Understand, are you playing with friends who know from school? Are they playing with people from across the world? And don't think that's necessarily a big, scary thing, but ask about it. Be curious about it. If you're a policymaker, also be curious about the spaces. Learn what people are being exposed to. Be very clear-minded about the risks and the threats that are there, but also the very real social benefits that can exist. And if you're a practitioner, right, if you've been working on prevention of violence or preventing violent extremism, or you're in a counterterrorism role, think about these spaces as an expansion of the human realm. These are spaces where people engage and exchange ideas, good and bad, and will become even more so in the future. As Jess was saying a minute ago, the potential for identity formation, the potential for group formation is huge. So if you want to engage meaningfully and investing in a safer, more peaceful human future, you have to be engaging in questions of online spaces, right, which we all agree on, but especially gaming and gamified spaces. So if you want to be working on building a better world, you have to be engaged with these places and do so with nuance, right? Ask platforms, ask gamers, ask policymakers, and ask a lot of people to bring to the table.
Thank you to our guests, Jessica and Galen, for their input in today's episode. If you want to learn more or get involved in the Extremism and Gaming Research Network, we'll share resources in the show notes. If you want to learn more about Tech Against Terrorism and our work, visit techagainstterrorism.org or follow us on Twitter at Tech versus Terrorism. I'm Anna Krane. This is the Tech Against Terrorism podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. And if you enjoy listening, please rate, leave a review, and share the episode, as that really helps new people find us. This is an OG Podcast production. Executive producer is Archie McFarlane. Produced by Adrian Dangor. Edit and sound design by Ollie Guillou. Music by Rowan Bishop.